Session number 9354.
The Honourable Lady Chichester, Reel 2. It was really very upsetting indeed for my mother, having taken the decision for three of her children to go off across the Atlantic. It was extremely dangerous because the convoys had been organised, but quite a lot of ships at that time were being sunk by German submarines in the Atlantic, and so there was considerable risk in crossing the Atlantic. And I remember within a day or so of them sailing, there was the terrible news came through that the Andorra Star had been torpedoed as she sailed across the Atlantic, with a lot of the German and Italian internees. A lot of the poor Italian waiters of London had been interned. And then they were put on the Andorra Star to be sent over to Canada, and an enormous amount of them lost their lives when they were torpedoed. So that, of course, made it extra. An extra anxious time for us, knowing that my brother and sisters were in a ship going across the Atlantic, just in a convoy with very little protection. They arrived in Halifax about 8 or 9 days later, and we heard very quickly that they'd arrived. It was a wonderful relief. They then went to Montreal with these great friends of my stepfather's, and my two sisters were sent to a girls' school in New Brunswick, and my brother was sent to a school called Ridley College in Ontario, which was an extremely good school, and I think his education didn't suffer at all. I think when they came back to England 2 and 2.5 years later, they did find it quite difficult to settle down again when they came back to English schools. That autumn, there were constant air raids. Mostly at night that I seem to remember, and my mother and I were always very worried in case an incendiary bomb fell on Palace House. Several bombs fell in Beaulieu. Two soldiers were killed in a gun emplacement, but no civilians were killed at all. I think one or two cows were killed one night on one of the farms, and one night quite a lot of farm buildings were very badly damaged, and one night two of the houses in Beaulieu village were badly shaken, one so badly it had to be practically rebuilt, but again, by an amazing bit of luck, nobody was killed. Palace House actually had one window blown out one night by a high-explosive bomb, but when you think what an enormous target Palace House was, it really is amazing to think that it never was hit. Some people think that, in fact, they never intended to bomb Beaulieu at all, that all the bombs that fell in Beaulieu were ones that were probably meant for Southampton or being offloaded on the way back from Southampton. Aeroplanes did that if they came over to bomb and they didn't drop their bombs on the correct targets. In order to lighten their load and get back to Germany quicker, they dropped their bombs wherever they happened to be. And I think that it's quite possible that the bombs which fell in Beaulieu weren't in fact targeted, they just happened to fall.
What did you do during an air raid?
Well, what we used to do is we used to get up and get dressed if it was at night, or we were dressed already. And we used to wander around the house, watching the raids over Southampton, which you could see very clearly. You could see the planes coming into the lights of the searchlights, and you could see the tracer bullets coming up from the AC-AT guns, anti-aircraft guns, searching out the planes. And as I said, I think a little bit earlier when I was talking about the dogfights at the time of the Battle of Britain, although it was very dangerous, and although you knew that any moment they could turn to the west and drop a bomb on you, in fact, there was something amazingly exciting watching the air raids going on. And we did. We always watched. Nobody ever stayed in bed during an air raid. And it used to happen a lot. In fact, I can remember night after night being up. And there's a very big room at the top of Palace House, which is called the Upper Drawing Room, which is now open to the public. And the big window looking to the east, you could see very, very clearly the air raids over Southampton.
Did you ever use any shelters?
No, we never used a shelter, absolutely never. But the cellars were all prepared to use as shelters, but we never, never went into them. The only time I ever went into an air raid shelter on purpose was when I was staying in Winchester with my stepfather's sister. And the air raid was over Southampton, not over Winchester at all, and was absolutely miles away. And I thought how very silly it was. We were all made to go down and sit in a sort of glorified cupboard under the stairs
in the middle of the night because there was an air raid over Southampton, and I thought, how awfully silly this is. And that's the only time in my life I think I actually went into a shelter. I can't remember the date, but I do remember one particularly severe air raid over Southampton. Bombs hit all the water mains, the telephone exchange, the town hall, and masses of the buildings above bar and below bar were absolutely blazing from end to end. And the Southampton authorities sent for help from all the areas round, and my mother and I went in. Of course, we always wore our Red Cross uniform for anything special in those days. And we arrived in Southampton, and we went to a Docklands settlement building somewhere near the bottom of the high street. And there was a canteen. And I can remember all the firemen with their hoses across the street and the car bumping over the hoses as we tried to find the place where we were meant to go to help. And that really was quite frightening because there were still bombs falling in some part of the town. I don't remember where, but maybe a little bit further north. And everything was blazing, lit up. You could see very, very clearly because the fires were so brilliant. And the poor fire brigade people trying very hard to get the fires out with the water mains all burst and the raids running in water. And I do remember that for two nights running, we went in and we manned this canteen. We weren't involved that night in any form of first aid. I suppose the Southampton Red Cross were doing that, but we just helped people and sat them down and gave them a bit of comfort and gave them cups of tea, and also cups of tea for the firemen, I remember particularly. We had been taught during demonstrations how to use stirrup pumps to put out incendiary bombs, though of course we didn't do it that night, and we all were very conscious of the fact that incendiary bombs were a very, very big danger, because in any city, if you can get all the buildings burning, it lights up the target and causes great disruption. And the Germans did use incendiary bombs a lot as part of their bombing equipment.
What sort of state were the people of Southampton in?
Well, I don't really know. I think everywhere around here people were just very angry, and they were all really in their own way fighting the war. I don't think we saw from Beulah the people of Southampton, but I do remember just the people who came in that evening to the Docklands settlement building where we were helping with the canteen. I think the feeling everywhere was the same. We were backs to the wall. The Germans were the other side of the channel, and we knew perfectly well that things were extremely tricky this side. I never saw ever any sign of what people would now call bad morale. In fact, I can remember some months later when General de Gaulle came to Beaulieu with General Spears and a lot of French officers. He stayed for 2 days in Beaulieu, and he came to Palace House one morning. It was a Sunday. I can remember him arriving after church. And his English was extremely bad, and my mother and I didn't speak very good French, but we tried our best. And I can remember him saying to my mother, "Are the peasants of England optimistic or pessimistic?" But of course he said it in French, and the word peasants in England we think is very funny, but General de Gaulle said, "Les paysans, sont-ils optimistes ou pessimistes?" And I remember my mother saying, "But of course, mon général, we are all optimists." And I can remember that quite clearly because it seems such a strange thing to say. We never, ever were pessimistic. We somehow were very, very worried naturally. But never, never for one moment did we think we would actually lose the war. From the very early days of the war, we were supposed to go everywhere with our gas masks. And to begin with, we all did. But of course, as the months went by, the phony war and nothing was really happening, people didn't, on the whole, take their gas masks with them. It was almost a bit of a joke, because I can remember one or two people in Beaulieu who never, ever seen even going to the post office without their gas mask. But we did have a lecture at Exbury, which all the Red Cross went to, on the use of gas masks and gas-proof clothing. And we realised there was a sort of vague idea that we might have had to use them. But I don't ever remember somehow thinking that we would have gas, and of course, thank God, we never did.
Was it one of your duties to show people how to use it?
No, I didn't have anything to do with that at all. I don't know who did. I expect the ARP people. But we organised for people to go to the lectures, rather like we did organising people to go to the first aid and home nursing lectures.
How did you receive funds for your Red Cross division?
Well, the funds were raised rather like they are now. We still had flag days and people donated money. We had our own local funds, which we used for things like the first aid equipment for our first aid depots, which we had quite a number of. And then I remember we suddenly heard that there was an American fund which was available where you could apply for special equipment. And so I wrote off to this fund because I'd heard that the Hythe Hospital was wanting to upgrade their theatre. Their theatre up to that point had been not a very large one, and I don't think they'd been capable of doing any large operations at that time. I'm not absolutely certain about the details because I never worked in the Hythe Hospital, but I do know that they didn't have very good lighting in the theatre. So I applied to this fund to get one of the very up-to-date new lights, which were anti-shadow, which at that time were fairly new. You could put your hand underneath the lamp when you were operating, and there was no shadow cast. And this was a very sought-after thing, as you can imagine, for any form of operating. And to my amazement and delight, it was granted, and the Hythe Hospital had this wonderful anti-shadow operating light for their theatre. And in fact, I expect it was possibly there for many, many years afterwards. About this time, I started to work in the Lymington Hospital as one of the Red Cross nurses from our newly Red Cross detachment. And I used to go off early in the morning. My mother lent me the car, and I had to be on duty at 8 o'clock. I worked mostly in the women's ward, which was surgical and medical in those days. It wasn't divided up. I enjoyed that enormously. The sister was extremely nice, and I enjoyed having a lot of responsibility. They were so short-staffed in those days that although I was not a qualified nurse at all, I'd only got my Red Cross training, I used to be sometimes left completely in charge of the ward. And I remember one day the matron coming along, who I knew quite well, and being rather angry because she found that the sister had left me completely in charge of the ward. And I remember her giving the sister a bit of a lecture and saying that she shouldn't leave me as a partly, well, she didn't call me partly trained, but she certainly shouldn't ever leave the ward entirely in charge of a Red Cross nurse. But in fact, it happened quite often. Obviously, had there been any emergency, I was able to quickly get hold of somebody, but they were so short-staffed that they were only too glad to have a pair of hands who knew a little bit what to do. I also used to work temporarily when they needed help in the X-ray department, which I enjoyed. I remember going into the dark room and dipping the plates in and out of some sort of solution. I didn't quite know what it was, but I used to enjoy doing that. I can't remember how long I worked in the hospital for. It seemed a long time, but I think I was ill at that time, and I think possibly it wasn't longer than some months. It was, certainly wasn't as long as a year, but I did very much enjoy that. Of course, later on, the Lymington Hospital was added on to enormously because, owing to the vast number of service personnel in this area, the hospital couldn't cope at all. This was not to do with wounded soldiers, but just the fact that there were enormous numbers of service people, Army, Navy and Air Force, in this area. Just the normal things from appendixes to any other illness the hospital was needed. And so they built on these two large wards entirely for service personnel. And that was the beginning of the hospital becoming quite a large hospital as opposed to being a tiny cottage hospital.
How confident did you feel when you were left in charge of a ward?
I don't think it worried me because nobody ever said, now I'm going to leave you in charge in that sort of way. They would just say, oh, I'm going off for half an hour to have my tea break or something, and just left me, and I just carried on with whatever I was doing. When I say I was left in charge, I was left in charge, but of course I could have always got help if I'd needed to. I didn't ever have to cope with a dire emergency at all, but one did all the things like the dressings and all the ordinary nursing duties. Of course, in those days, too, there was much more changing of dressings, which very seldom happens now. Nowadays, people have dressings on for much longer, and they don't touch them sometimes for a week or two. And also, of course, later on, there was penicillin and all those M&B sulfur drugs. But at that time, dressings would be changed at a minimum every day, and in some cases, more than once a day. So that was quite an important part of nursing work. was putting clean dressings onto people who'd had operations.
How did the patients respond to you as a Red Cross nurse?
Oh, I don't think they really sort of registered on the difference. I mean, they could obviously tell because my uniform was different. I had a nurse's cap on with a little Red Cross on front, and I had a big Red Cross on my apron. But I think everybody was just called nurse, and they probably thought I knew a great deal more than I did. I don't remember being treated in any way differently, really.
Were you given any specific training when you went into the hospital work? Because this was different from your other work.
No, I wasn't given a specific training, merely that the staff nurse or the sister would show you on a particular job how to do it. For instance, all the urine tests we used to do. I mean, whatever you were asked to do, obviously if you didn't know how to do it, you'd say, could you show me how? And that's how you learned, but there was no extra course involved.
What sort of hours did you work? Were you going in every day?
I know that I started work at 8 a.m, and I can't remember what time I went home. I suppose it was probably an 8-hour. I really can't remember that. It seemed to me a day's work, whatever time I went off duty. It was probably the hour when the night staff came on, whatever time that was. But I can't actually remember.
And how many days a week?
I think I worked every day a week. I expect I had a day off. But I seem to be going to work every day, I think every day. I don't remember.
And was this on a voluntary basis?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I never got paid. Completely voluntary. My mother, I'm sure, paid for the petrol for me to get there because I wouldn't have had any money to pay for it. But everything that the Red Cross did was voluntary. Nobody was ever paid for anything. I don't say they weren't paid, of course, if they were called up and sent overseas on a job. That was probably quite different. But I never, in fact, was. So I'm not certain how that worked out. But when I worked in London much later in the war, we were paid, absolutely minimal, because then I was working in a headquarters office.
Were you the only Red Cross nurse taken to
No. There were two other girls from the Beaulieu detachment that worked there. One girl who worked almost full-time in the X-ray department, and another girl, I'm not sure which ward she worked in, but she was waiting to be called up. In those days, when you reached a certain age, you had to register, and then you were called up, and you were put in one of the armed forces. Either you were made to be a Leon girl, or in the WAFs, or the REMS, or the ATS. You had to do war work. I can't remember exactly what age you were, but I think it was the year you were born. And I know that I was born in 1921, and I know that suddenly a moment came when I had to go with another girl of my age and register, because the year for the 1921s to register had come. But as I'd already been doing war work and already been working in the hospital, they didn't suggest that I went off and did anything else. But when my sister came back from America a year or two later, she started off as a Leon girl, and then she registered, and she put down a preference that she'd like to go into the REMS, which in fact she did. Sadly, I had to give up working in the hospital when I was ill for a bit. And after that, during the time I wasn't supposed to be well enough to do my full-time Red Cross work, I started teaching a group of children in Beaulieu, who were the children either of service people in the area or people who lived in Beaulieu. And my mother gave me the old nursery in Palace House. And I had at one time as many as 8 children, all different ages, from the age of 4 to 10. Now, I had them in different parts of the room according to the age group and ability. And I really rather enjoyed that. I did that for some time. I can't remember quite how long. I was never taught to teach. I was never trained. But I think I possibly may have had a bit of sort of facility for doing it because I really enjoyed teaching young children. I also taught my own young brother, who was only about 5 or 6. I taught him to read and write and do his early sums. That, of course, was in addition to all the sort of Red Cross work we were still doing, such as manning the first aid posts when needing, and the duties with the ARP office.
What sort of first aid work were you being called on to do in Beaulieu?
Well, the sort of first aid work was purely in the local first aid post, which we'd set up in the army units. The house where my mother lives now in Beaulieu, called the Lodge, had been taken over by the army. And the little room inside her front door was a first aid post. I don't know how many soldiers there were involved in that particular unit, of maybe 200 or 300, and there was always something going wrong. And so 3 days a week or something like that, at 10 o'clock in the morning, another girl and I would go up, and we would, rather like a doctor's surgery, we would sit there, and the men would come in one by one with their problems. They were none of them major problems, because had they been major problems, they would have gone to the medical officer. And we did that. We did that up on the Air Force headquarters up on the forest. We did it at the Army station near Bully Road Station. It was a regular thing, and some mornings we'd have a lot to do, and some mornings there'd be very few people.
What was social life like in the Bewley area?
Well, the social life really was terrific, because there was an enormous number of army units in this area, also the Navy, and a vast aerodrome, which was on the submarine patrols out into the Atlantic mostly, where the Liberators were stationed. That was up on the forest between Bewley and Brockenhurst, Bewley and Lymington Road. And so, naturally, the commanding officers of all units wanted to have some form of entertainment. Some form of entertainment for the troops. And my mother was wonderful and said that they could have the Domus, which is a beautiful, very big room attached to Bewley Abbey, for dances every single week. There was such competition to go to these dances that each unit used to allow so many of their men and their girls, the ATS or the REMS or the WAF from the Women's Royal Air Force from the aerodrome, to come. And the whole room used to be absolutely packed solid to the safety margin. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it was something like 200 was the maximum my mother thought was safe in that room. They weren't allowed to send any more. And one of my jobs used to be, with help of course, was to organise these dances. And in fact it did need a certain amount of organisation. We had to make sure we got the music each week, and also the heating too had to be organised, and the tickets to make sure that each unit only sent the number of men or women that they said they were going to send. And of course for all the girls in the village it was marvellous, because there were very, very few girls compared to the numbers of men. And there were a lot of local romances took place. It was a very happy arrangement. And I think my mother was very popular indeed, because she allowed this to happen. One very special and interesting thing that happened in Bewley during the war was the fact that 9 or 10 of the Bewley houses were taken over for the training of the SOE, which was the Special Operations Executive, the undercover people who were parachuted or sent in other ways into Europe to get in touch with the underground and carry out works of sabotage against the enemy. They were very, very secret about everything they did, and we never saw them at all. The only people we knew were the headquarters staff, who lived in a house called the House in the Wood and the house called the Rings. We knew them. They used to be there for 1 or 2 years. But all the people who came to be trained were brought in at night and taken out at night, and nobody ever saw them at all. One of the people who was trained in Bewley was very famous. She was the woman called Odette Churchill, whose exploits were made into a film. She was a very, very brave woman, and I think she was captured by the Germans.
How aware of you were you at the time of what was going on?
Oh, we knew. Nobody talked. But you knew. You never, never asked anything that could have been an awkward question. It was a sort of unwritten rule. You just didn't. But the officers who were stationed running the show, we really got to know very well. One of them was Hardy Amis, who was a man who, after the war, started a very famous haute couture dressmaking business for men and women's clothes. In fact, he's still one of the big manufacturers of rather expensive, rather good clothes. There was another man who wrote songs very well, I remember. They were a very, very intelligent, very nice lot, and they were all bilingual in some European language. It didn't take you long to discover that. Mostly bilingual in French for some reason. They'd been brought up abroad, or their mothers or fathers were French. Some of them spoke Dutch, some of them spoke Flemish, but they all were bilingual in some European language. And we used to really see them at almost every dance. They used to come down and join us. We never, never went there. And the first time we ever went there was the night when they had a terrific party just after V-Day, that meant Victory in Europe Day, and we went for the first time through the doors.
Did you ever see them training?
Oh, no, never. Never saw anything at all. It was all done at night. But various very peculiar things would happen. The Beaulieu River is a wonderful sea trout river, and occasionally it was found that a whole lot of dead fish, rather sadly, would be floating on the water. And then you knew that somebody had thrown a hand grenade in, which must have been great fun for them, because then they had lots of lovely fresh fish. That sort of thing happened, and you knew it was people from that establishment who'd done it. And we also had a very strange thing happen in the Palace House one night, and we realized that it wasn't a burglar break-in, that it was just some of these people being trained who were having fun. They broke a window in Palace House somehow, and they got in. They went into the kitchen, and they took food out of the fridge, and they went down to the dairy down in the cellar, and they put some chicken bones into a bowl that was setting for cream, and it was all trailed all the way up the steps into the kitchen with chicken bones and cream. And then they went into the library where they took my knitting bag, which was very annoying, and took a couple of things like ashtrays, and they took a check of my stepfather's off his table, which was quite valuable to anyone, no good to anybody. And then they went, and of course the police said, look, it's no good us looking, but we're quite sure it wasn't a civilian thing. And my mother got on to the commanding officer and said, look, and there were great apologies all round, but I think they were out one night on a training exercise and thought it would be rather fun to see what they could do.
What about the other villagers? Were they aware of the SOE?
I think everybody knew, because nine houses is a lot of houses, and they all knew they were occupied by the army doing something. And I think people in those days were very, very wise. They didn't chat about things that really mattered. I mean, we all just knew. But what was very interesting was that there was a man who took a leading part in the Home Guard in Beaulieu called General Buckland. He was a retired Gurkha, come to live in Beaulieu just before the war. And his daughter worked in the Red Cross detachment with me. And we just knew him as one of the retired officers in the village who was a member, and a very active member of the Home Guard. We used to see him walking about Beaulieu in his Home Guard uniform. And it wasn't until after the war, when my brother, Lord Montagu, offered the SOE to have a very beautiful memorial, which is now in the cloisters of Beaulieu Abbey, that I realized that this Brigadier Buckland was during the day a perfectly ordinary Home Guard officer, and at night, apparently, he must have been picked up in the dark and whistled off to London. And he, in fact, was the senior officer organizing the whole of the special operations in this area, and nobody knew, including his own daughter. And his own daughter only discovered after the war what her father was doing.